Hello and welcome into another edition of SaaS Whispers. My name is Jay McFarland, and I'm very excited to introduce you to our next guest. We'll talk about how the history of SaaS can be a guide for the future, also how to manage all of the good of SaaS while minimizing the detractors. We'll talk about how security should be a major consideration with choosing SaaS, and how asset management can ensure that SaaS in your organization doesn't get out of control. To help us with all of these issues, let's bring in Mark Haupt. He's the Chief Information Security Officer at DataBank, and he has some great insights on how to manage SaaS security and avoid a problem that we're calling SaaS chaos. All right, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show today. I always like to start out by asking, are you in an industry where you thought, that's what I want to be when I grow up? Or was it something a little bit different when you were younger?
Well, sort of a kind of. How's that?
Yeah.
So when I was growing up, this whole IT industry was not what it is today. So I grew up in the 80s. And to be quite fair and honest, when I grew up, I wanted to be Tom Cruise flying the F-14 Tomcat. I started high school my freshman year, the year that movie came out, and the first time it came out. And so that's what I wanted to be. But, you know, even to be more fair than that, I grew up military. So whenever I saw that movie for the first time, and as I was growing up, I grew up around the Tom Cruises of the world, the real fighter pilots. Wow. And so I knew that that's what I wanted to be. But then in high school, first of all, I didn't get the grades that I needed in order to become that. And I kind of fell into this whole IT and networking thing. I worked in the library, and our high school was putting in a network during the summer of 88. And because I worked in the library and all the teachers knew me, they said, hey, I got a little summer job. You want to come help me pull the cable? And I'm like, yeah, sure. Why not? What is this kind of thing? And then from there, I started taking home Apple IIe's and IIc's and playing around with them and so on and so forth. And so when I couldn't join the military as Tom Cruise, I'd still join the military as a cryptologist. And that's when I got my first real experience with security. Now, with that, I was still doing the network type of stuff, and that's what attracted me. The things that I did at the high school attracted me into doing that communications function as a cryptologist in the Navy. But then I started learning at all the security protocols and dealing with encryption and dealing with maintaining secrets as secrets and so on and so forth. So long-winded answer to your question was, as a high school student, no. But as soon as I joined the military, as soon as I was an adult, this is what I've wanted to do, and this is what I've longed to do for my entire life. I wake up enjoying doing this every day. And when I've taken a slight detour on my career path for whatever reason, you know, I did a period of time where I was the chief technology officer of an organization, an academic institution, and I did a little bit of a stint as essentially an IT manager at an internet service provider in the late 90s. Every time I've done that, I've either always found a way for security to be a key part of that or come back to security as my first love. So there you go.
Well, I love it. I love that you found your passion. That's not always easy to do for people.
No, it's not.
Yeah. And so I'm assuming you get up in the morning and you're excited to get to work and get back at it again.
Almost every day is that case. And the only days that it's not that case is when I've never gone to sleep the night that, so I never have woken up from that morning. And there are some times, you know, as those of us that have been in IT and inside of security, there are those times when incidents do carry over. And, you know, I've done, even this year, it's been a while, but this year I had to do a 40-hour day. And yes, at the end of that day, people were going, go to sleep, go to sleep. I'm like, no, I want to know what's going on.
Well, I have to imagine in security, that is not a standstill industry. It has got to be moving at 1,000 miles per hour. How do you keep up with all of it?
Well, you see, I have no hair, right? That's number one. It goes away because the steam just rolls off your head. And so how do you keep up with it? First of all, is you do have to pay attention and you do have to dig in and you do have to make time for reading and understanding concepts, not only within the security industry, but with IT in general, because the most of security right now is directed at IT, and especially what I do working in the data center industry, it is all about IT. So I have to maintain an understanding of everything from the workstation security all the way to, you know, Oracle and, you know, all the big systems that are out there. So I have to do that. But the other key piece, and probably the more important piece, is having a team that works with you and that you trust. And I don't mean just security people, but I mean in a decentralized concept, the IT people, the people that are in charge of the cloud, the people that are in charge of the networks, trusting them that when they come to you and they're raising the flag, or even trusting them to handle things without my knowledge as a CISO, in other words, not coming to me with absolutely every little thing and having to force me to micromanage, is a key important piece of how I get my job done. I can only get involved in the absolutely most important things that are out there, because there are so many things to deal with. There are so many concepts. There are so many incidents and issues that go on worldwide that may or may not affect my company, but I still need to be aware of them so that I can have conversations like this, or I can be aware of them in case they do impact my company. So as example, you know, unfortunately, there was a large networking company that's recently had a major attack that was announced against them that was a ransomware scenario, but it was a deviation from ransomware. And this somewhat new term popped up in the the aftermath and the understanding of that. It was called MFA fatigue. And I never heard that term before. Now, I've heard the fact that, you know, sometimes people will use multi-factor authentication and try and looking at different ways to break it. But I never heard the term MFA fatigue. And I know it's been out there for a while. But I dug in. That was one of those things I was like, that's something I need to dig into, because that looks to me like it's going to be a method of attack going forward. And sure enough, now since I've done that, not just because I'm aware of it, but because new attacks have occurred since that attack in July and August, just here it is in late September, and I've seen two additional scenarios where MFA fatigue was a key aspect of the attack vector. So that's one of those examples where, you know, I have to know what to dig into and understand and learn in order to protect my own environment. And so I turn around and use that as security awareness training for my team, saying, hey, if you constantly get these pings on your phone saying, you know, accept, 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 don't accept, give us in security a call so we can address it and block those, so you don't succumb to MFA fatigue and go ahead and punch the button that accepts it just to get it to go away.
Yeah, I'm amazed at how we keep up with security, because isn't it true that often you're only as good as your worst employee? I don't want to say worst, but I mean, how do you keep things secure when somebody's picking up a hard drive and plugging it into their machine, or they're just clicking a link that looks like their bank? It seems right. Next to impossible.
Well, it is impossible, and that's one of the messages that I put out to my team, is that it really is impossible. But the more and more that I can teach and make people aware, the less and less risk we have. And that's one of the good things that I find about working where I do now, is that we've educated and we've evangelized what we do so much that even the slightest scenario that looks off, I have people at the highest levels of our organization coming to me and saying, this doesn't look right. What do you think? And they're not afraid to do that. What we've done is, and I think that's the key piece, is what we've done is we've created a culture that doesn't scold a person for being wrong. It doesn't scold a person for being skeptical, for, you know, as they say in my world, I get paid to be paranoid. I'm not asking them to be paranoid or to get paid to be paranoid, but I'm asking them to at least approach me. And we've created a culture that allows for that. And it's very important. My response to them is affirming their, even if they're wrong, to affirm what they've done and to be willing to bring that to us, because I can't do this all myself. Even my team can't do it all by ourselves. We need everybody within the organization to put as many fingers into the hole of the dike as we possibly can in order to block what's going on. But, you know, reality is that an attacker is going to go towards the weakest link. And if we can cut as many weak links out as possible, perhaps they'll just go away. And the ones that we actually deal with are those that that are very sophisticated types of people, and that we legitimately need some help to defend against, because we're not a three-letter agency with the federal government.
Right, right. I love that culture you're talking about. It's kind of like when a parent says, you can come to me with anything you want, and then they come to you and the parent freaks out. You know, it's like, you can't be that way. You've got to have a culture of, come to us first. We'll figure it out. You're not going to be in trouble. Share those with us so that we can all be better.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very difficult sometimes, because you know, you look at some of these messages and you go, oh, I got to bite my tongue on the response on this one, because it really is. That really should have never come to us. But I really want them to come to us on the next one, or I want them to pull the plug when they think they're seeing ransomware the next time, instead of coming to me saying, well, 20 computers were infected before we finally shut down the situation. And who knows what happened as a result of that. And the multiple hours that we have to go through to recover from that and figure that out forensically about what really happened. That I would much rather somebody pull a plug and be wrong, and or come to us with a stupid looking email and we affirm them anyway, than, you know, have to deal with the aftermath.
Yeah, I had a friend who was recently catfished, and it ended up getting into their system. And one of the things he said to me was, he knew this person for months. He knew them for so long. He had this relationship. There's no way that they could be a problem. And I don't think they understand how patient these people can be. Mm-hmm. They'll go months, they'll go years before they actually initiate on something.
Right. And that's always something in the back of my head. You know, I try, you know, when I'm doing things like this, having conversations with you, I get sometimes these people come out of the blue that I have no relationship with, no knowledge of. And I sit there and think, is somebody trying to get in my back door at a later point by pretending to grab my weakness of being willing to do marketing or to, you know, have these types of conversations, because I truly enjoy evangelizing security and it's a passion of mine. But I do have to be careful that, you know, at some point the guy that I'm talking to is not taking that information and utilizing it to get in my back doors. So yeah, that's the thing we have to deal with all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really curious about SaaS. SaaS is something that I think saved us during the pandemic. I didn't know how we were going to survive it. We all went to our homes. We were all using this type of software. But the security risks have got to be tremendous, because you could be, this employee signs up for SaaS over here, another one over here. You don't know where your data is. They're calling it SaaS chaos. I mean, how do you function in a world where it's so easy to sign up for these types of applications?
Yeah, it's very difficult. And probably the best advice I can give in that is have a very, very strong corporate policy on what a person can do on behalf of your organization from signing up these things. And then couple that up with some technology that will either detect or prevent that type of scenario. So, you know, I'm a firm believer, and I've been around long enough in the IT world that everything comes, it goes, and then it cycles back and it comes back, but it comes back in a new name. And so, you know, many, many years ago, we had the distributed computing model, and that was basically many, many cloud environments. And now we're talking about cloud and SaaS, and that's really the same thing up in somebody else's world. And so, you know, how do you deal with this? Well, I think we need to circle back around to reconsider our policies and enforcement of those policies with technical means. And one of the areas that we used to do all the time, because it was the favorite tool of HR, were proxy servers that would detect when somebody was going out and hitting porn or hitting some site that they weren't supposed to hit, right? You know, back in the late 90s and early 2000s, you know, when I worked at a Fortune 500 company, we had to monitor that thing daily of what our employees were doing. Not necessarily, they were more concerned about that than what was coming into the environment. And I got a few stories about that too. But, you know, I think we probably need to come back to a scenario where, hey, even if you're at home, you have to connect to a VPN in order to get to these SaaS tools. And as a result of doing that, you have to go through some sort of proxy server that will block the traffic that you surf on the web. And we need to have technology tools that will help, and beyond that, that will help the policy to be effective, such as some sort of endpoint protection tool that will not allow you to change the proxy settings, that will require require your traffic on your corporate laptop to go out only through the VPN. So no split tunneling, for example. Used to be that was a very popular thing, is to cut down on split tunneling. And then we went to this COVID thing and people started doing it the other way because so much traffic was going into environments that it was clogging up the VPN concentrators or the firewalls that were running the VPNs. And so they pulled back on that so that only the necessary traffic goes in and the unnecessary traffic goes straight out to the web. And so I think we need to kind of pull some of that type of stuff back and have a little bit more control, a centralized control on what's going on in order for us to properly maintain and manage those types of things.
Yeah, I think that's very good. I'm curious, if you had a choice, on-prem or SaaS, which one would you rather have, or is it a combination of both?
By far SaaS, or we'll just call it cloud, because SaaS by itself honestly doesn't work.
Right.
You have to have infrastructure, or you have to have platform layered on top of infrastructure and SaaS layered on top of platform in order for it to work. But my honest answer is SaaS, and there's a couple of reasons why. Number one is that, you know, all too often CISOs focus on the confidentiality and the integrity in that CIA triad and forget about the availability piece. CISOs need to work to enable the business or they will not be successful, period. And so one of the ways that we're enabling the business is for allowing and securing SaaS environments. It can be done. I mean, the company I work for right now is a cloud provider that provides infrastructure and platform as a service. We have effectively done that with and for the federal government, Fortune 500s, Fortune 50s, financial institutions, medical care facilities. We can effectively do that, but the company has to choose the right controls and they have to know what they're dealing with and have the right technology people in place in order to make that happen. And so going back to your initial question, why would I choose SaaS over on-prem, is because quite honestly, at this given point, SaaS is more flexible, it's more mobile, and it's more cost effective. So not only do I work for a very large company that does data center operations and has our own cloud, but I also get to see the other side of it because I volunteer for a rather, I would say a smaller academic environment. And so you can call them, you know, under 300 people, you can call them a small business. But I get to see that side of it as well. And I'm their volunteer chief technology officer, if you will, just kind of do it on the side to help them out. But it's incredibly beneficial for me because I get to see the flip side of what we as a cloud provider provide. And I get to help you get to see the decisions that have to be made. And in that type of organization, we have to be ready to go online fully at any given time. And I'm sure that's the case with many businesses. You know, we could have a resurgence of COVID as a pandemic. We could have a new situation come up. And, you know, I think one of the things that COVID's taught us is that any of the any of the things that normally CISOs would be called stupid for dreaming up as possible scenarios during a tabletop exercise are now things that could be possible. You know, we've seen civil unrest in the United States to an extensive degree that we've not seen before, at least since the 1960s. So therefore, not before inside of the technology realm here in the past 5 years. And so companies need to know how to address that. And on top of that, I believe that there is although there's a little bit of a slowing on it, I believe there's a revolution right now of where people work. And we have to be willing to accept that and be able to work with that and secure that. We can't just stick our heads in the sand and say, nope, you can only be on-prem. And that's the only way we can secure this. That is not going to make you a successful CISO. So there's a lot of reasons for us to go SaaS. And then, of course, there's also risk transference and risk mitigation as well that can occur. And, even to the point where there's just not enough technology people in this world where the small, medium-sized businesses can afford to pay a technologist of any value to work inside of their business. I mean, you know, that's one of the reasons I'm volunteering at the university that I am, is because they just can't afford somebody that has the experience and the and this sounds a little self-serving, but it's not intended to be. It's just fact. They can't afford somebody that has the technology experience, background, and capabilities that I or anyone similar to myself brings to the table. And so by volunteering here, I relieve them of some of those requirements, but yet they get the expertise and knowledge. And by moving things off to the cloud, moving them off to SaaS, they're able to take advantage of some of those economies of scale that they currently can't, because they would have to hire 5 or 6 IT people to handle all the different things that are going on. They just simply can't do that.
Yeah, I remember the days before SaaS of telling somebody in IT in our company, hey, we need this change. And they would just look at us and they'd say, do you know how long that would take? Or we can't do that. You're crazy. And I mean, the wheels would turn so slowly. Whereas now you have a company that focuses on one particular area. And that's what I love so much, is they become an expert in that one thing. And they're very agile in making changes. It's one of the reasons why I love SaaS so much.
Right. And then, you know, the whole gig economy is essentially SaaS. You know, if I need a particular programmer to do one particular job, that gig economy is essentially SaaS for the workforce. And they can come in, they can do that one thing, and then they get out. So that expertise comes in and works. And I don't care whether that's, you know, in the company that I work for, or the place that I volunteer at. That's who we are these days. We are a world that needs that flexibility and mobility. And if we can't change to adapt to that, and we require on-prem, our company probably is not going to survive. But going back to something I said a few moments ago, what goes comes back. So at some point, there's going to be something happen. There's a catalytic moment that causes people to rethink that and bring it back on-prem, or at least certain things on-prem. Mm-hmm. So yeah, be prepared for it. It will happen.
Yeah. And you also mentioned how it's changing the workforce. I have a job right now I can do anywhere in the world with an internet connection. And it's made me rethink my whole life. It's like, why do I live where I live? Why do I commute? Why do I do these things when I can do my job from anywhere?
Exactly. Last Thursday and Friday, I was doing my job, and had I not told anybody, nobody would have known it, from a hotel in Virginia Beach, because I went to visit some friends that I hadn't seen in 27 years. And we wanted to go to the meet there and go to the Naval Air Station Oceana Air Show, because we all grew up military and that was kind of a thing for us. And so had I had that situation 5 years ago, I would have had to scramble out to fly out on Friday afternoon, take a PTO time, get out there, and then rush my weekend and get back. Well, I was able to fly out there on my own time in an evening on Thursday, or on Wednesday rather, sit there and work all day Thursday and Friday from the hotel, see them on Thursday night, have dinner with them, go back to work on Friday, you know, and nobody knew the difference because I was able to do that. So you're absolutely right.
Yeah, and if you have to, put up a green screen like I do in the background so you don't have to, so you don't have to worry about it. I am curious, when you're looking at a new SaaS application, what do you look at? How do you know that they're secure? I mean, what types of things do you assess before you bring something on board?
Yeah, a couple different things that you can do. So first of all, look for audit reports. Things like your SSAE 18 or SSAE 20 is transitioning to the 20. And inside of that, go down to the, you know, not only read the descriptions of it and identify what is in scope, whether they deal, you know, which of the five trust principles they deal with or all of them, but go down to the actual results of the audit and look and see if there's any exceptions in there. So that's going to be a key thing from a pure security perspective. You know, same thing if it's a medical, application, look for a HIPAA report. If it's a an economic, you know, credit card type of financial transaction scenario, look for the PCI reports. So look at those, see what the third party auditors have said about them, and determine what's going on. Do a little bit of background investigation on the on Google. Or even go so far, depending on what this application is for, go so far to have somebody, don't do it yourself because it can get you in trouble, but go so far as to hire someone who's a security professional to go dig on the dark web looking for various things about this SaaS provider and the product that they're offering, see if it's been breached, see if there's any back-end information, back-end you know, chatter going on, if you will, between the hackers that are out there, and just see what you come up with. So evaluate it from that perspective. So that's, of course, all on top of your typical evaluations. Will the product even work for you? What are the features on it? So from a security perspective, when you're looking at features, make sure that you can apply the encryption keys yourself and you can retain the keys, because that's another assurance that probably the provider can't get to your data, especially on a database or something similar to that. Make sure that the security controls are very transparent and you can modify them to your needs and strengthen them if necessary. So those are all pieces that I would look at from a security, purely security perspective.
Yeah, I love that. What if you suspect a possible breach with one of your SaaS providers?
What do you do if you suspect it? So they are currently a provider. Well, there's a couple ways to address that, but first of all, I would be talking to your legal counsel to make them aware that you have the suspicion. Number one. Number two, don't assume that they know that they've been breached. Number three is kind of what I just talked about in regards to the dark web. Hire somebody to go out there and take a look on the dark web of what's going on, because more than likely, if they've been breached in a significant way, the data that's been breached or some chatter about the breaching has been placed on the dark web. You know, we found out last week as a result of some of those chatter pieces that were going on about a certain rideshare company that has been breached. Their internal systems have been breached, and we found that out because of the chatter that was going on. So look at that, and then finally, you know, when you've got your evidence, then finally, and I can't stress this enough, politely, don't just go up there with all your evidence and throw it on the table and say, why have you been breached? But politely go to your provider and say, look, we have some indications that there may be a security situation here. Could you share with us your perspective on this? What's going on? And hopefully, and the reason I say do this politely is because they may not know about it. Or if they do know about it, their legal counsel may have already told them to be zero comment, shut lip about it. But if you politely approach them and collaboratively approach them, and then you say, well, here's my, because more than likely, if their CISO has any value, their CISO is either, if they don't know about it, they're going to say, what are you talking about? And can you share with me why you believe this? And then you can share with them any evidence or information that you have for them to evaluate, and you can continue to work collaboratively with them on that. But if you go in defensive and you go, or even offensive, shall we say, if you go in there with a hair on fire and slam things on the table, in, you know, virtually, and say, you've been breached, here you go. You're going to get no collaboration out of it. And because I guarantee you, these are going to become legal situations, and you want to be on the supportive friend side of this rather than the arm's length, we're not talking to you side of it, inside of it, because you may have to deal with situations, notification requirements, and so on and so forth. And so go in as a friend, go in as polite and respectful as you possibly can, and look to work collaboratively on it.
Yeah, because I think one of the issues is that your customers, they have no idea if you're using a SaaS application. So when you have, when your SaaS company has some type of breach, they're looking at you. They're not, you can't just say, hey, it was them. They're looking at you, and they want a resolution from you, correct?
That is correct. They do. And so that's one of the reasons I said engage your legal counsel first, is so they're aware of it and they can handle any potential communication that goes out.
Yeah, very good. So I have a couple of concluding questions. These are not necessarily SaaS related. I would like to know, before I get to them, do you recommend like SaaS management systems? I'm seeing these systems come out where they identify all of the SaaS programs. They show you which ones are being used, what the costs are associated, and those types of things.
You know, I'll just be honest with you. I don't have a lot of experience with those. I can see where the ones that I've seen, I can see that they have value, because you can compare, you know, almost comparison shop in them. But I have never actually taken the opportunity yet where I've needed to use one of those, dive into it, and fully understand it. And
that's fair.
In one of my responsibilities, I'm strictly focused on IaaS and PaaS, and the other situation already have systems, and I haven't had to reevaluate them yet. So,
well, very good, very good. All right, three quick fire questions here. What are your favorite books or podcasts right now?
Okay, favorite books. I go from different subjects to different subjects. I just finished a book that is called, it was about Jennifer Doudna and the DNA or mRNA type of situation. I can't remember what it was called now. It was a long, I do a lot of audiobooks. It was an 18 hour long audiobook.
Wow.
And so that's one that, you would think that it has nothing to do with technology, but it was very interesting to show how biotechnology is very similar to IT technology, and the whole encoding and decoding. And then, of course, it makes you very aware of what's going on right now in regards to engineering genetics with the COVID situation and so on and so forth. So that's one that I recently read, and I wish I could remember the name of it. And then I'm a huge fan of Jocko Willink's, especially his book regarding the whole idea of extreme ownership, and the various follow-on books and the podcasts that he does. I also follow Mike Rowe and his podcast that he has. Typically nothing about technology, but you see that I'm when I listen to these types of things, I'm actually trying to expand my non-technology mind. So, you know, bringing more of the quote unquote, if you were in an academic institution, liberal arts thought process into it, or having more input than just what you focus on in your work, allows your brain to rest a little bit, but it also allows for some education pieces on it. So,
yeah, and I find it all tends to flow together. You may be listening about something completely different, and it triggers something in your own mind about your own profession.
Yep, I'm not going to be able to do it. I was going to say, I was going to try and look up that book, because it was a great book that was about Jennifer Doudna, and I would highly recommend others to look at it. And so I was about ready to look up the title of it, but, you know, it escapes me at the moment.
That's okay. We'll find it. One final question. Biggest takeaway from this podcast, if there's something you wanted to drive home and make sure people understood, what would it be?
I would think that security as a culture is absolutely important for you to employ security anywhere, whether it's SaaS, whether it's on-prem. You know, security as a culture is, in my opinion, what is going to save you. You know, going back to that example I shared a little bit ago, 15, 20 minutes ago, about MFA fatigue, that situation would not have become a situation in the news had even a stronger, there's probably a good security culture to begin with, but an even stronger security culture existed. The one thing I saw in that was of failure by the individual was they didn't report the consistent over 2 to 3 day period MFA requests coming into their environment. And I don't know what this organization has from a culture perspective, but I do know that if that person did not feel comfortable contacting their IT department or their security department saying, I'm getting bombarded by these things, what do you want me to do? Then that in itself is a challenge. And I do not want that in my organization. So as I described, having an open culture where somebody can bring to you stuff that may not even be security related, but they think it might be, will save you at some point. It is an investment. Culture is important.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, I appreciate your time and your experience and your insight. It's been a real pleasure talking to you today.
All right. Thank you. And it's been the same.
Absolutely. Once again, I want to thank Mark for joining us today and for sharing his incredible insights on SaaS security, on how to manage these systems, and how important they are for the future. We hope to talk to him again sometime soon. Again, my name is Jay McFarland, and thank you for joining us on this edition of SaaS Whispers.